can see that this case has generated a lot of interest. We have one case this afternoon, number 16-2705, Schiftel Entertainment, Inc. versus Digideal Corporation. Mr. Anderson.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, we're back. We were last here this summer. The weather was a little better, but since then, the automatic stay of the bankruptcy court in Washington has been lifted. It was lifted as of last month. And the appellee, Digideal, obviously has elected not to participate in the appeal. They filed no appearances, corporate disclosure statements, or briefs, and they're obviously not here today.
Does the lifting of the automatic stay apply just to this case or generally?
It was limited to this case. Yeah, it was. The order was entered in August, and the debtor asked the bankruptcy court, I was there, asked the bankruptcy court to postpone the lifting of the stay for a couple of months so that the debtor could appear and ask for leave to participate in the appeal. And that's why, although the order was entered in August, it was not effective until October 23. In any event, they didn't do anything. So, but it is limited to this case. And I don't mean to suggest that this procedural default entitles us to any automatic reversal, but I do think it reflects a determination by Digideal not to throw good money after bad, trying to defend the judgment below.
If we do reverse, what's going to happen on remand? I mean, I assume the district court will undertake the intervening rights, but is Digideal out of bankruptcy? I mean, are you going to be able to get anything other than a default judgment against them?
They are still in bankruptcy, but they have not gone out of business, Judge Hughes. If you go to their website, it's www.digideal.com. I checked it last night. They're still an active competitor in the gaming industry. They're in Chapter 11. They're not seeking dissolution, and they're working out a reorganization under Chapter 11. And I also checked on the status of it today, and all I can see is that the proceedings are still ongoing with the parties filing motions and the creditors working with the debtor. So they're still in business, and the bankruptcy proceeding is still going. But to answer your question more directly, in our view, what should happen, and I'll get to the district court error in a minute, but the judgment below should be vacated and should be remanded to the district court to determine whether or not the new and amended claims that the Patent Office issued here were substantially identical to the original claims. And then if they were, then to determine whether or not there are absolute or equitable intervening rights available to the defendant under Section 252 of the United States Patent Act. So,
would you agree that if the claims were substantively changed that you have to file a new complaint?
No, I don't. I think the statute is clear, Section 307A in conjunction with Section 252. I think the statute is clear, and I think that a couple of decades of jurisprudence in this court make clear that if the new and amended claims did you say are substantively identical?
Yeah.
If they are substantively identical, then
No, not substantively identical. If they're substantively changed.
Oh, they're substantively changed. Okay. If they're substantively changed, then it's incumbent upon the district court to determine whether there's either absolute intervening rights, which relieves the.
No, but my question was, do you have to file a new or amended complaint?
No. Yeah, a good question. But under the local rules, you have to do what we did, which is you file amended infringement contentions. It's Nevada local rule. Now I got it in my notes here. I think it's 16.1. But you can amend your infringement contentions at any time up through the close of discovery under the Nevada local rules. And so what we did, after the Patent Office issued its re-examination certificates, we then served and filed amended infringement contentions, and we asserted the new and amended claims, and we mapped all of the limitations of each claim to the accused product. So that's how you do it, and that's what we did. We did it pursuant to the rule, and we did it in a timely basis.
Should we, on appeal, address the question of whether they've been substantively changed? Because it seems to me there's a pretty good argument that they were, in the sense that this flush with the table limitation was added to overcome prior art.
Well, as you know, Judge Dyke, the fact that there's new verbiage, new language, does not mean that there's been a per se change in the substance of the claim.
No, but this was more than just new language. It was new language that was added to overcome prior art that was cited against the original claims.
Yes, it was. But here, I think, is the applicable test. A claim that's made more definite or to avoid an ambiguity is not a substantive change in the scope. And what the district court has to do is, as I understand this court's precedent, it's much like a Markman hearing. You have to properly construe the scope of the claims, obviously looking at the intrinsic evidence and patent prosecution history, and then you have to determine whether the added language or the new language substantively changes the scope of the claims. Now, that analysis was not done by the district court below, although we did provide in an appendix to our summary judgment brief an example of the proper analysis, and we picked as an exemplar claim, we showed that claim 42, original claim 42 of the 982 patent, was substantively identical to the scope of the claim 1 in the 982 patent. So we presented to the district court an example of the proper analysis, and I would suggest that we only need, you know, one claim that is substantially identical to avoid the doctrine of intervening rights. And we did that analysis by way of exemplar. We gave it to the district court, but of course the district court didn't act on it. A couple points. One is, I don't agree that there were substantive changes in the claim scope, which I could explain, at least as the example. And secondly, I think it's clear that the record on this is not developed. The district court has not construed the claims, nor done any of the required analysis. I hope that was responsive to your question.
Well, it is, but why isn't the amendment... Didn't all of the claims get amended to have the flush from the table limitation?
Well, certainly claim one did. I think that's right. But I'll give you an example of why we do not think that that was a substantive amendment. And that is because, again, the rule of law, the governing principle, is that adding a term that's consistent with the specification that makes a claim term more definite is not a substantial change in the scope of the claim. And if you looked, and I'm sure you have...
But an amendment that's necessary to overcome prior art is a substantive change.
No, I don't agree with that. I don't agree that triggers a per se rule. In fact, this court has said to the contrary, which I'll find the site in a moment, but I want to call your attention to the specification.
But if you have a claim that is broad enough to include the prior art, you add a new limitation that takes it out of that prior art, isn't that by definition a narrowing amendment?
Yeah, but I don't agree that that's what we did. I think I don't agree that the change we made was to avoid the prior art. The change we made was...
So to reach that conclusion, we would have to find that that limitation you put in explicitly was already implicitly there?
Yes, and that's what I was getting to in the specification. The specification, and this is in the 982 patent at column 25, lines 18 through 20, and this is just an example of where it's at, but the specification talks about having a card shuffler where the upper surface is proximate with the elevation of the gaming table. So,
but it's not a question of what the specification says, it's a question of what the claim says, and that limitation was not in the claim in the first place.
Well, that specification helps clarify the meaning of that claim, which, by the way, has not been construed by the district court.
Well, if you want us to interpret that claim in that narrow way, wouldn't, under our other case law, that specification language have to be a clear and unambiguous disclaimer of claim scope?
No, I don't think so.
Isn't that the only way we read specification terms to limit otherwise more broad claims?
I don't think so. I think the operative rule of law here in determining whether or not added words to an amended claim change the scope require a Markman-like hearing
but
to determine the scope
of
the
Markman. If we have this general claim language, we do a Markman, and we determine what the scope of it is. And if you're urging that specification language, which is not in the claim, should control and limit that claim, then in ordinary claim construction principles, we require it to be a clear and unambiguous waiver, don't we?
No, not a waiver.
I'm using the wrong words, but you know what I mean. It has to be a specific definition of that otherwise broad scope. Otherwise, we don't read terms from the specification in.
No, of course not. You don't add limitations by reading them into the scope.
And
but
so
if there's an ambiguity or a lack of definiteness in the claim term, you will turn to the specification.
Well, where's the ambiguity?
For guidance.
I thought it just didn't contain that term.
Well, it's clear from the specification that was the intent and purpose and uniqueness of the invention. It's clear from the invention history that was the inventive idea. I'm sorry.
Let's put it this way. Suppose we disagree with you and we think that the original claim did not include a flush with the table limitation, okay, and that was added during the reexamination. Do you agree that if we reach that conclusion as to the original claim scope, that there was a substantive amendment?
If you agree that claim changed the substantive scope, then yes, then we have to do the next step in the analysis is to determine what the intervening rights are. The judgment below still has to be reversed. The district court then has to determine what the effect of that is, and under absolute intervening rights, the defendant would be relieved of liability for pre-issue damages. But it doesn't, even under that scenario that you've outlined, Judge Dyke, it doesn't result in extinguishment of the case. The district court still has to determine.
The only question is, can we hasten this thing along by resolving the substantive amendment question here? And it seems to me that it's boiling down to the question of whether the original claim included a flush with the table limitation.
I don't deny that you have that power to do so, but I think that the practice and precedent of this court is to review analyses and decisions by the trial court, let the trial court do the analysis first, and the trial court didn't do that analysis, nor has it really been briefed. And
is that because you think there needs to be a Markman, or can we just look at the claims and construe it ourselves without the benefit of a hearing? I mean, what would you put on during a claim construction hearing?
Well, I would put on all the intrinsic evidence contemplated by this court's precedent, which would be the prosecution history, the specification, and the claim language.
Don't we have that?
Pardon?
Don't we have that? I mean, you certainly have the claim and the specification.
Yeah, you have the claim and you have the specification. But no one at the district court level has done that analysis, and as I understand this court's jurisprudence, the practice is to allow the district court to do that first and then review it on appeal. I'm not saying you don't have the power to do it. I'm just saying it wasn't developed below. It wasn't even briefed below.
I'm just trying to get at what you think you would develop before the district court that isn't already before us in the record.
Well, the best answer I can give you is that I'd go back and review the prosecution history. I'd go back and review the specification for more exemplars from the specification than I just gave you kind of off the top of my head. And I'd look at other claim of the language in other claims. There's many, many claims in the patent. I would assemble all of that and present it in in Markman-like fashion and have a fully developed record. That's the best answer I can give you, Judge Hughes. But I'll say this, that even if a judicial officer reaches the conclusion that the new claim or the amended claims are not substantially identical, the judgment still has to be reversed because the court retains jurisdiction to award post-issuance relief, either damages or injunctive relief. And I would also add that under well-accepted jurisprudence, if this were a case like Fresenius, which it is not, because here we have new and amended complaints, if the case is totally moot, as the district court seemed to think it was, the proper procedural device pursuant to Rule 12H3 is, if a court has no jurisdiction because it's moot, you lack Article III standing, the district court must dismiss. The district court has no jurisdiction to be entering judgments for anybody, and that was yet another error that the district court made by actually entering judgment for the defendant without any finding of non-infringement or invalidity. The district court concluded erroneously that the case was moot when it was not.
Well, can I ask, what would be insufficient in your view about allowing the district court judgment to stand and your being left to filing a new lawsuit under the re-examination certificate?
Yes, a good question, and one that
consider both possibilities, that yeah. there was a substantial change and that there was not a substantial change.
Yeah, a good question, and one that came up in the target training case, if I recall it correctly. And so the answer is the judgment that was improperly entered may well have res judicata effects. At best, the district court should have just dismissed the case. But as long as that judgment is out
for there... For ASPICS-type reasons?
Pardon?
For reasons like the one at ASPICS or ASPICS or something?
Yes, ASPICS, yes. ASPICS. As long as there's a judgment out there finding, in effect, that that no infringement or we have no claim, I've got res judicata problems. We've also got a whole judicial economy and efficiency problem. We invested a couple years in this case with discovery and a Markman hearing and a tutorial, and it seems to be absurd, requires to start all over again. So for those two reasons, most importantly, starting over in the face of a judgment is gonna, I'm sure, the other side is going to argue res judicata.
Well, I think Target helps you on that, doesn't it?
I think Target said dismissal on mootness is not a judgment that triggers res judicata. And I would agree with that. Had the district court below just dismissed, we would not face res judicata problems, but that's not what happened below. The district court entered a judgment for the defendant. So we are different from Target Training, although that issue did come up in Target Training.
Anything more? Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The case is submitted. That concludes our session for this afternoon.
All rise.